This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you are listening to Ecotopia, a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. I'm Susan Chudy.
And I'm Stephen Chudy. About a year ago, we did a program with the title Making a Living While Making a Difference. We were talking with Melissa Everett, author of a book with the same title. She told us about some of the ways in which activists can find satisfying careers, being a positive force in their community, and make a few bucks on the side. Tonight, we'll revisit the topic, talking with authors and writers of two new books on that topic.
First, we'll talk with Dave Ojala, a co-author of a book entitled Making Good, Finding Meaning, Money, and Community in a Changing World, published by Rodale. Dave is the founder of Dream Now, a charitable organization that works with young people to develop, fund, and implement social change projects.
Then we'll talk with Neil Gorenflot. He's co-author of a book called Share or Die, Voices of the Get Lost Generation in an Age of Crisis. It's published by New Society. Neil is the founder and publisher of Shareable magazine. And we'll also talk to one of the contributors to that book, Hannah Brencher. She is the founder of a project called The World Needs More Love Letters.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by Alternative Energy Systems, a locally owned and operated partnership providing sustainable energy for life. Alternative Energy Systems offers residential, commercial, and agricultural energy solutions by calling 345-6980 or at solarenergyforlife.com.
We want to remind you the opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, or programmers. We'll be back to talk with Dave Ojala about Making Good right after this short break.
I'd like to see your badge. Who are you to be so brave? With one arm free to catch yourself, and you're using it to wave. Who are you to be so strong? You can't leave it all behind.
You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR, and tonight we're focusing on making a living while making a difference in the world. On the phone with us now is Dave Ojala. He is co-author with Billy Parrish of a book entitled Making Good, Finding Meaning, Money, and Community in a Changing World, published by Rodale. Dev is the founder of Dream Now, a charitable organization in Toronto that works with young people to develop, fund, and implement social change projects. We're delighted to have you on the program, Dev.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's great. We want to hear all about Dream Now, which seems like a fabulous and important project helping young people find meaningful work. But first, we'd like to hear a little about your story. How did you get to the point where you decided that you wanted meaningful work for yourself, not just something that to quote your book, might be dead end in law school.
Yeah, no, I mean, the dead end in law school thing is actually pretty funny because it actually came out of all these conversations with different friends of mine, and every time that we're actually doing it, you know, that we're actually found ways to make money and do good, or it's stumbling along through their careers. And every time that they would go home, they'd come to their parents and be like, this is what I'm doing. I'm consulting for this, or I'm interning here, or I've got this job with this nonprofit, or with this B Corp, or whatever. And they'd be like, well, have you considered law school? You know, my father still does it to me sometimes, and it's unbelievable. But just what we've found and where my path has taken me is just, I basically was doing follow-up for youth conferences. So I was talking to thousands of young people each year, and I realized that the conversations all were around the same thing. Okay, I know I want to do good. I know I've been raised. I understand climate change is going on, but how do I actually get a job in this stuff and not just work for nonprofits? You know, actually be able to live the life I want to live.
Right.
So we set out to try to answer that question.
And you described Dream Now as a scrappy little project when you first got started. How long has it been going? Now it's a major operation. You're raising hundreds of thousands, even millions of dollars to support it.
Yeah, it started almost 10 years ago now, which is sort of hard to believe because it, you know, started off when I was in university, and it's just been growing ever since. Right now we're working on launching a job training program, which is based on the book and can be found at makinggood.org, which is the idea of helping people actually get the jobs that, you know, make money and change the world. And what we've been seeing, and once we started the book, is that, you know, there's tons of people that have been in jobs for, you know, a decade or have these real skills, you know, maybe, but they're tired of selling toothpaste.
Right.
But they don't maybe have that mission alignment, you know, or they don't understand quite what it means to take action or get a job in the do-good world. And then there's also thousands of people that want to do good and have the mission alignment, but they don't actually have the real skills. You know, they're just like, I just want purpose. Like, come on, give me a job. So what we're doing is actually running a training program that gets the people with skills, gives them a mission, and the people that just have that mission stuff helps them get those real skills they actually need.
And so do you do this directly, or do you do it online, or, you know, how do you bring these people to your program?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of both. I mean, it starts at makinggood.org. The book was the first step of that, which is like actually laying out tons of resources that we've been found after 2 years of research and actually starting to tell some of the stories of where these opportunities actually are. Because what we found is once you start asking people, you know, you can rattle off like, you know, become a teacher, become a lawyer, become a doctor, become any of these professions that we know from our parents. But then when you start to think, how do you actually, what kind of job does it look like when you're actually making money and doing good? There's just a blank.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's hard to think about that. And so what we started doing was gathering all these stories that, you know, range from, you know, everything, people that are actually rethinking, redesigning, and rebuilding every industry you can imagine in a way that does good. And that's where the jobs actually are.
So what are some of the kinds of projects that Dream Now catalyzes? Can you give us some examples?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can talk about some of the individuals that we reached through Making Good. So, and that have been a part of the whole Dream Now program. There's one that has this girl named Sarah Proder, who I just got an update recently. We wrote her story in a book, and she was a nurse for 5-6 years and was realizing that the way the buildings were built were actually hurting nurses, how high the cabinets were and the way that the setup was. And so she set out to try to change that. And, like, so she went and she was like, I'm going to do interior design. She did an interior design degree, realized that you're just changing the surface stuff, and then tried a different angle and ended up in architecture school. And, you know, to try to actually think about how do you get an architecture degree to rebuild hospitals in a way that's actually meant for healing and for patients and for the protection of nurses. And I just heard from her recently, and she actually found this job just right out of school, like one of the only people in our graduate class that got a really great job that is perfectly at that intersection of, you know, health and architecture, rebuilding hospitals in a way that's sustainable and good for both the people. Right. And it's like these kinds of opportunities in every single industry, from party supplies to coffee grounds to architecture, that somebody's out there is rethinking like basic industries in a way that does good, and there's actually jobs in that.
Could you tell us a little bit about the party supplies?
Yeah, I was curious about that too.
Yeah, yeah, sure. There's this these two people we interviewed, and one of them is Emily Dublay, and they run a company called SustyParty.com. And basically, they just, you know, saw those red keg cups and decided to, like, what if those could be green? And what if they could be sustainable?
Right.
And they opened a sustainable party supply shop, and it's doing really well. And just, like, all the party supplies you need, you know, you can get them, and it's just sustainable and good for the world, and all the kinds of tips on bringing friends together and all that kind of stuff, too, that goes along with it. So it's basically every single industry you can possibly imagine, and that once you start looking and once you sort of turn your head to the opportunity, there are actually people that are hiring and rethinking industries in a way that does good.
So really this is based on this kind of desire and need for change that people are feeling, but it's getting the people who want the change with the people who have the skills to make those kinds of changes.
Right. I mean, like, all these companies need people with real skills. You know, they don't need people that just want to do good.
Right.
They need accountants. They need project managers. They need people that are good in operations. They need people that are good in finance. They need all the same thing that normal businesses need, because at the end of the day, they're running a business. But the whole nature of the business is actually doing good for the world. You know, so the one thing that we're telling people that, you know, really have that desire is, like, pick something that's a skill and really go out and build it. You know, even if you know you're working in an industry you don't like necessarily, or that you've been working in it for 10 years, it may make you the perfect person to be rethinking that industry.
Mm-hmm.
And it may actually give you that skill base that you didn't even realize you were sitting on.
Wow, yeah.
These companies need.
Could you talk a little bit, please, Dev, about how you encourage people? Your book is really upbeat. And in a lot of ways, you're saying it's similar to advice our parents often give us. That is, dream your dream, go for it, go get it. That's not easy. People get discouraged. It's a long, long trek. How do you deal with that in your workshops as you're getting people to make to climb every mountain?
Definitely. I mean, the way we broke up the book was we took a lot of these skills that, you know, we've heard about in career development, or we just know, like, reflect and ask those questions and how to connect and adapt. But we approach them from the angle of what is different about what's going on today? And how do you actually need to do that if you're getting a job in a space where people are actually pretty movement-focused?
Mm-hmm.
And actually feel like they're working together. And you need the person that's working on the electrical car battery, and you need the person in the car manufacturer, and you need the person that's working on the policy stuff in Washington, and you need to work together with everybody. So looking at some of these basic skills of, like, reflecting and adapting and launching yourself into your new career and thinking about them in terms of what you need to do today. So, I mean, a real concrete example is we have this concept of the nonlinear career path bring out in the book, which is, you know, if you start down your career and all you hear is, you know, you're going to be a lawyer, you know that it's going to work out, or you have this idea that it's going to work out. But when you jump from internship to a paid position to maybe back at home to a side job to, you know, traveling abroad to, like, running your startup in the social good space, it's hard to know that it's going to work out because you just don't have the stories of that sort of non-linear career path paying off. And so we help people sort of realize that they're in the middle of it all and realize that they can actually, you know, have the confidence to pursue it.
And you do, in fact, say begin in the middle, not at the beginning.
Totally, yeah. That is definitely realizing you're in the middle. And this can apply to people from all different ages, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's so exciting about it is that, you know, you have people that are in their 50s and 60s that are, you know, have 25, 30 years of experience in a career, actually being the perfect person to reinvent that industry. Because they know it inside out. You know, they know and have the real skills. And those companies, those mavericks that are out there that are actually trying to restart it or, like, get that startup funded, they actually need you more than anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and those are where the actual jobs are, and they're actually paying well. You know, that's what's so different.
Yeah,
these aren't nonprofit jobs.
Yep. And so you can pay the rent with the job that you've created for yourself here. I mean, you can make money doing what you're doing specifically.
Yeah, so I mean, what I'm doing is, so Dream Now is a part of it, which is doing the job training program, and that's like a charitable organization, foundation funded. And then what I'm personally launching right now is a recruiting company, which basically takes people with those that have the skills and the mission, that have those perfect intertwined, and getting them jobs in these great companies. So that's sort of the other part of what I'm working on right now.
And that seems like a huge useful thing to do, because some of the problem is hooking those people up, the people with the skills and the people with the money and the people that have something underway already.
Right. Yeah, yeah. It's definitely connecting those dots. And, you know, what's nice is it's about real relationships. And it's almost one of the things we found in the book when we started talking to entrepreneurs is it wasn't always about, you know, just scaling to be the biggest or, right. you know, trying to make the most. There was, like, getting down to those core questions of, like, well, what is enough? You know, how much do you need and what kind of business do you want to run that will enable you to really make good, mm-hmm. you know, and find that balance for yourself? And those were the kinds of questions people were asking. You know, Eli, this guy that was running a small burger shop in downtown Flagstaff that was all sustainable, and he had a master's in, you know, sustainable architecture or sustainable agriculture. And, like, he had all this knowledge, and they brought it back down to the most concrete thing for him, which was actually giving people healthy, organic, local food.
Right. Right.
You know, and there's just so many different answers to the problem, to the question of how do you make money and change the world.
Right.
And there are so many exciting people that are actually working on this stuff right now. So.
And in Making Good, you talk about a six-step approach to finding meaningful work. Maybe we could just go through some of those briefly. We want people to read the book, obviously.
Yeah, no, definitely.
So maybe you could give us a bare outline, and then to go into depth, they should buy the book.
Yeah, definitely. So the ones we go into are reflect, which is about getting clear on some of those basic principles before you dive into it, and, like, asking some of those fundamental questions that we simply don't ask, like, you know, what, how much money is enough for you, and how do you want to be spending your time. The second one is adapting, which is the rethinking how we educate ourselves today. Because people that are coming out of university are still feeling lost and feeling like they don't have the skills. But there are so many ways to actually get the skills, especially when the whole industries that are being reinvented aren't that old. You know, your professors maybe two more years of experience than you.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way to get that information that's not necessarily just coming through the ways that we've been taught. And then we go into connecting, designing, launching, and organizing. Connecting is one of my favorites, and there's this one idea in the book, which is the intention is the message today. So it's this idea that, you know, we're all pretty aware of when, you know, we're almost overflowed or over flooded with information and messages, whether it's Facebook messages or Twitter or emails, and, you know when somebody is being authentic or wants something. Really quickly. Like, we have a very quick read on it when it's actually like, hey, how's it going? You know, what's going on? And it actually cares about you. Mm-hmm. And versus, like, trying to get something from you. And it's just a simple idea of, like, building your relationships based on the idea of each message you send out, it's not what you're writing. You know, you can send a one-sentence Facebook message, but if it's the intention behind it, being like, oh, you know, this is just a really good chance to check in with my friend, and just that's it. Not like check in my friend and hopefully get them to come to my concert. You know, it's they will get that message.
Okay.
And I did an experiment, which I talked about in the book, where I tested this out, where I sent postcards to, I think, 75 people or 50 people. And I noticed when I just did it all in a row, and it started out being, you know, really, like, real heartfelt, like, remembering moments and sending these little postcards and notes in the mail. And by the end of it, you know, I just got tired, and I was just like, hey, great, how you doing, blah, blah, blah. And I tracked which ones worked, and I didn't really know it was going to happen. I definitely wasn't thinking about the idea, intention as a message. But what happened was all the people that I actually wrote those real notes to actually responded, and all these opportunities came out of it, and actually all this stuff came out of just the first half.
Wow.
You know, I think it's because we just have actually such a good read on this stuff today than we've ever had before, because we're so inundated. So it's tips like that that are sort of real, concrete things you can do, all that help you build your network and get prepared to actually find a way to make money and do good.
Wow. And design, launch, and organize, those are the last parts of the process.
Yeah, exactly. So design is, you know, thinking about the planning, and the launch is actually making that first ask.
Right.
You know, pitching yourself for the job. And then organize is, you know, there's some things that are rules of the game that actually need to be changed. So, like, once you're on the other side, once you're doing it, you still need to be working with others and experience that great community. As soon as you decide to do this stuff, you'll be looped into an amazing community of people that are doing similar work, and it really, really feeds the soul.
Dev, we're often interested in this program about how people learn what it is they're doing. We often find that people learn it on the job through alternative processes and so forth. You alluded to university education. Two-part question. Could you talk a little bit about how you learned what you know how to do? And could you comment a little bit on the educational system and how that feeds into or doesn't feed into the kind of model you're discussing?
Right. I think, I personally have learned a lot by just doing things. I started Dream Now when I was in university, and that's the kind of person I am. I have that sort of ability to sort of go for it and learn and fail and try again. But what we found was that it's actually all the way across the board, from people that learn, on the street, learning and trying things and failing, to people that are actually learning in schools, and taking that knowledge and those real skills and then applying them to new ways. And it's that sort of interdisciplinary thinking that's really paying off. It's in the same way that Sarah Proder took an architecture degree, which, maybe 98% of the other students just went regularly into a normal architectural practice. But she took that architecture degree, which is a normal education, and combined it with her life experience, which she learned through actually being a nurse and actually, being in a hospital, and found that sort of perfect cross at an intersection for it to actually do good, and actually rethink hospitals in a way that does good. So it's a real combination today of people learning on the street through apprenticing and through real education and, with the internet and our ability to just actually tap into some of these open education networks and, MIT OpenCourseWare and all that kind of stuff that enables us to actually have access to all this knowledge and bring that together to sort of find our own educational path that fulfills our need.
I'll offer a little editorial comment here. We're both former academics, and we're really frustrated by the disconnect between a lot of academic work. It still sounds as if it's up to the student or the individual to find those connections. That there aren't a lot of schools and universities that are really building that in. They'll offer an internship. After you finish your major, you get to go out and work for free for a semester. But there's not a tight transfer of the learning.
Definitely. And, it is totally individual right now. A lot of that responsibility is on you. And, that's why it's really hard for people to figure this out if they don't see the models of other people following that individual path. Because all the models that are given to us in the educational system, as you allude to, are really linear models of what we should do and how we should connect the dots. And so with Making Good and makinggood.org and all the stuff we're trying to do, it's like trying to bring up these other stories of people that are connecting the dots in different ways and starting to see how can this education actually be applied to an industry that it may not have ever been thought about. But, that class you took or that TED Talk you listened to or, that person you met with that job you spent an hour talking to, how does that apply to the industry you're passionate about rethinking, redesigning, and rebuilding? And in that, there's a chance to really do some good and, actually tie together your own educational path.
So do you see yourself here at the beginning of a trend that this is going to be the way that people start? I mean, it seems like with the, a lot of the traditional jobs going away with kind of what seems to be a big change in the economic structure with, like when we started out, our career path, as you described earlier, was clear. But I think for lots of young people, that's not true anymore. So maybe this is the new way that people will work toward work.
Yeah, and I think it's a new way, but it's also addressing the same needs, a lot of the same needs that are actually being fulfilled by the current economy, but they're doing it in a better way that's actually cheaper and more sustainable. So it's not like trying to come up with a whole new, need or industry necessarily, but it's approaching some of these industries that we've rely on and that we interact with every single day. You can just trace your steps for one day and think about all the different industries you interact with and pick any single one of them. And then just try Googling and looking in that one industry and try to figure out who's doing something sustainable in that industry or who's rethinking it. Right. Or look at the Forbes list of the people that are emerging or look at the, list of people that are actually coming up and rethinking these industries. And you'll start to see a whole world of people that are getting investment or pulling their resources together actually hiring and actually trying to figure out how to do good with that same industry you interacted with already.
That's pretty cool.
And one of the reasons why that they're actually hiring is because a lot of the time, when you trace it back, the industry that's entrenched actually is investing in these startups.
Right.
And
right.
is actually putting the money there because they know things are shifting.
Right.
Right, but and they want to make sure their position is covered. But they don't want to tell you about it necessarily. But they're doing it, and the money's flowing in that direction, which means in the next 5 to 10 years, that's where all the companies are going to be.
Nice.
And that's where the industries are going to be on a status quo.
How can people learn more about the work that you're doing? It sounds like sort of a consulting position that you're working toward and the Dream Now project. Can you tell us how they can learn more?
Yeah, definitely. People can just go to makinggood.org, and you can get connected to the book and all the job training programs that we're going to be coming out with in the next few months. And there's an email list and all that kind of stuff. But, go to makinggood.org, and we'll definitely love to hear from you.
I also want to mention another of your books, Occupation Changed the World. It's available online as well. I found that a particularly interesting discussion of the nonlinear career paths. We'll put the web link for that and makinggood.org up on our own website, ecotopiakzfr.net. We want to thank you, Dave, for being with us today. Dev Ojala is the co-author of Making Good, Finding Meaning, Money, and Community in a Changing World. The book is published by Rodale. Listeners, be sure to check out those websites. Thank you very much for being with us tonight, Dev.
Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
Uh-huh. Bye.
Take care.
You are listening to Ecotopia on KZFR, and tonight we're talking about ways people, especially but not exclusively young people, can find meaningful ways to engage with the world in personally rewarding ways and still find resources to pay bills and lead a reasonably comfortable life. We have two guests on the phone with us tonight. From San Diego is Neil Gorenflo. He's the founder of Shareable Magazine, founder and publisher, and he's co-editor with Malcolm Harris of a book from New Society Publishers. It's called Share or Die, Voices of the Get Lost Generation in an Age of Crisis. Welcome, Neil.
Oh, thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Susan.
Uh-huh.
And then also on the phone with us from New Haven, Connecticut, is Hannah Bruncher. She's one of the contributors to the book. She wrote an essay, Heartbeats and Hashtags, Youth in Service. She's also a writer for Save the Children and founder of a website and a project called The World Needs More Love Letters. Welcome, Hannah.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You both have great and eye-opening titles for your work. Let's start with Neil. Please tell us about the title of your book, Share or Die. Who are the contributors, and where did you find them?
Yeah, so the title, actually I got the title from a homeless man that I met on the platform of the Mountain View Caltrain station. He asked me for money. I gave him money, and we started talking. He asked me what I did for work. I told him I published an online magazine about sharing, and that really struck him, and he goes, I know about that. When you're homeless, it's share or die. And that really got under my skin, and we started using that phrase, in conversation about the book project when we were developing it, and it just stuck. The contributors, most of them come from Malcolm. I mean, I met Malcolm when he was 22 years old, just out of University of Maryland, and very bright, passionate writer, and he, fanned out and found these fantastic writers through his network.
Mm-hmm. We should tell listeners also that this is a book of stories, narratives. It's also got some cartoon strips in there. It's not a philosophical abstract treatise. It's the real stories of folks who've figured out some elements of the sharing process.
So what were your criteria, just one more second, Neil, with you, what were your criteria for contributors?
That they had a good story and they were passionate about their story and they wanted to tell it. And we wanted a variety of voices. We sought out young voices. We wanted it to be about young people telling their story and so that the reader could really relate to these stories and find meaning and a diversity of kind of experiences. So it's an interesting mix of young people in different fields and different backgrounds, a great mix of both men and women in there as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And Hannah, you've written Heartbeats and Hashtags, Youth in Service. You talk a little about being fresh out of college with lots of debt and living on not very much money in New York and calling yourself a volunteer. And you're doing a lot of projects now. Can you tell us a little bit about your story?
Absolutely, yeah. I kind of always knew coming out of college that I was going to have this debt as I was piling it on. While I was at college, I was at a private school, and so the debt seemed inevitable. I took a lot of student loans. But I always knew that coming out of college, I really wanted to be able to do a year of volunteer service. I knew that probably once I entered the workforce, there would never really be a time in my life for me to really step back and get some perspective and be out of my comfort zone. And so I decided to do a year of service in the Bronx, New York. And I lived on the third floor of an immigration center. And while I was there, all of my loans were put on hold. So I'm sure they accrued plenty of interest that I'll be paying off. But it was really challenging. I lived on $25 a week. I mean, the housing and everything else was paid for, so we had to make sure we didn't have to pay rent or anything.
Right.
But to only have $25 and to work in Manhattan and live in the Bronx was a really challenging thing for me, especially being right out of college and being right out of a social sphere where, you knew everyone, you were comfortable with everyone, and you didn't have to worry so much about money. You'd get a part-time job. And the challenge of this year was to not work and to really just stretch to the limits with what you were given and learn to live simply.
Mm-hmm. And So tell us about some of the projects you're now engaged in. You have a project called The World Needs More Love Letters. I love that. Could you tell us a little bit about that and the speaking that you're doing and Save the Children?
Absolutely. Well, The World Needs More Love Letters, actually the premise and the story behind it started while I was in my year of service. And so to deal with my emotions and to kind of deal with everything that I was seeing and witnessing in the Bronx, I started writing these letters and leaving them all over New York City when I would go into work at the UN. And I wrote about 400 to people all over the world that had requested them from me, social media. And it really kind of grew into an organization. And I just left Save the Children 2 weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
I put in my notice there, and I am now freelance and working on this organization that has become a startup. So
amazing. Mm-hmm. Amazing. And so tell us just a little bit more about how it works, and then let's move.
The organization,
More
Love Letters?
Uh-huh.
Basically, what happens is people can come onto the site, they can request a love letter for somebody in their lives that needs one, whether it's a mother, whether it's a friend, a boyfriend, someone they barely know. And then we find strangers, campus groups, classrooms to write these letters and mail them to me. I bundle them up and I mail them to somebody who has no idea they're going to get anywhere from 15 to 100 letters in their mailbox.
Wow, that is so cool.
It's a great project.
Thank you.
Perhaps either of you can respond to these next few questions, Neil or Hannah. The title of the book includes the Get Lost Generation. Can you tell us who the Get Lost Generation is, how that relates to Gen Y? And you also talk about Gen G at various times in the book.
Yeah, right. I'd love to hear what Hannah has to say, what her perspective is, but I'll just add mine real quick, which is, I mean, for us, in thinking about the book and the title here about this Get Lost, I mean, it references other generations that were quote unquote lost, but this is a different type of loss. This is getting lost on purpose. So young adults just out of school find that the old dream of success is not really open to them or even desirable. And so they need to get lost to find the new thing, to find that new definition of the good life. And that's, I feel like, what's represented through the book is a collection of voices who are telling their story about their exploration, their seeking. What's really promising to me is sort of this idea like, that, you know, a sort of monolithic dream, you know, the American dream is sort of dying, but in its place, maybe what we have is many definitions of success and many paths to fulfillment.
So what are the ages of the Get Lost Generation, would you say?
Well, I mean, we kind of thought of it as the sort of audience for this book are young adults, you know, just getting out of school, or even in a place where they need to really reinvent their lives and do a lot of exploring. And I think this is a perfect book for a young adult who's in transition.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so this could be, you know, from 18 to 30,
mm-hmm.
Maybe even a little younger or a little older.
And Hannah, what do you think of that generation?
I mean, it's interesting to be within the generation, especially because, you know, coming through college, a lot of adults were telling, you know, myself and my generation, like, well, good luck out there, but it's not looking in your favor. The economy is really bad. There's no jobs. You have student loans. And I think that the things that apply to the old American dream really can't apply to us because we can't afford it.
Exactly.
It's a big hindrance for us. And I think it's so true about the getting lost is that what I did is considered a gap year. And to a lot of people, that is a stigma. Like, you can't figure it out if you're taking a gap year. I have to say it was the most eye-opening experience for me and the best thing I could have ever done for myself. And I would encourage it to people in my generation, especially because we don't really know where we fit in. We're in this crazy digital age. Everything is moving so fast, and we get lost in it. And I think the first instinct is kind of like a fight or flight. I'm going to go out, and I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to have benefits, and I'm going to have insurance. But is it necessarily going to make me happy? Am I going to be passionate? I don't really know, you know? And from that gap year was a real time of challenge and struggle, but I also was able to open my eyes up to the world around me, which is where I think the whole Gen G comes in, the generosity is that I think my generation were really geared towards helping others and towards social issues and human rights and fixing those issues. And I will never turn my back on those things again after my year of service. Mm-hmm. The things that I saw and I witnessed, I'm so much better for it.
We'd like to hear a little bit about education from both of you. Earlier in the hour, we talked with Dev Ojla, who's written a book on making money and doing the right thing. He works up in Toronto. Your book, Neil, has a chapter on bad education, and another one describes learning outside the academy. And Hannah has just talked about needing the gap year. Let's start with Hannah. You don't have to name the school if you don't want, but... What do you think about your classy private education at this point? I had a similar one, I have to say, and how it equipped you for this kind of enterprise.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I feel as though in terms of values and morals and all of that, it was a great experience. And I was a sociology major, so a lot of that geared me up for what I was walking into in my year of service. But I think that it was because, it was a private education. It was definitely a very sheltered existence for that 4 years. And then you walk out into the Bronx, New York, and all of a sudden everything it's switched and it's swapped. I was a minority while at my private school. I was part of the majority and never understood why we needed all these minority trainings and all this stuff. And I think that walking into this, I was stunned, and it was definitely a mind blower, and it was something that sitting in a desk could not have prepared me for. But I think during my college education, at least, I took the initiative to go on service trips and to step outside of the box a little bit, but I think that made me more prepared as opposed to somebody that might not have taken that step would probably have just seen a completely different world right off the bat.
Right. Neil, comments on the state, impossible question, the state of education generally and how it might adapt or evolve in more productive ways.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I mean, it is a terrible preparation in some ways. It's an education that it prepares young adults for a world that's rapidly disappearing. And while enslaving them in debt. So, George Orwell, said that poverty annihilates the future. So you go to college to prepare for your future, and then you're enslaved with this debt, and you can't think beyond paying your bills and making your payments to your student loan. So it kind of cuts off the future for a lot. So this is a terrible dilemma that it puts. And it's immoral. I mean, I believe also. We have a couple of articles about young adults pursuing kind of non-traditional education and more self-styled or finding community of practices, which I think that's what I see emerging and the ways that young adults and anyone can educate themselves is to find places where peer education is just a way of life. So there are workplaces that are like that. They're very diligent about training their employees. They're dedicated to that. There are contexts like hacker spaces and co-working spaces where peer learning is integral to the experience. And I feel like also that online there are so many resources now, Khan Academy, all the open educational resources that are available, universities that are putting their course material online for free. There are courses, engineering courses at Stanford that are taught online for free to tens of thousands of people from around the world. So a new horizon, I think, is opening up for education. And I think the young adult who takes their education into their own hands understands themselves well and knows, you know, what they're passionate about, or at least is comfortable with exploring, and on certain teams really, really, really latch on to something, is, I think, a person like that has a big advantage. And you kind of have to have a sort of new attitude and a new sort of level of agency. So it does put, I think, an additional burden, but there's also a freedom there as well.
That's a very strong answer. I wanted to chip in with a little story. Today I was over on the Chico State University campus at the Cross Cultural Center, heard from two really vibrant young people who organize off-campus activities for students, and we got much the same message that they wanted people to be engaged. Kids were doing great stuff out in our community, but it was almost always independent of coursework, and students had to learn on their own how to locate these experiences rather than finding a track through the organized educational system.
Right, yeah. I mean, I can relate to that, because one of the sort of ideas about Gen Y is that they've sort of had helicopter parents and very structured experiences, and then they're thrown into this world of turmoil and uncertainty, this kind of childhood may not have prepared them for this sort of uncertainty. But I think a kind of new ecosystem also and a new culture is emerging that will be very helpful and that will prize that way of learning, that it won't be a stigma not to get a college education. If, for instance, you develop like a really cool project and you put it on Kickstarter and you make a killer video about it, and you really set it up, and it's something you're really passionate about, and you get your community behind it, and you create this project that probably is something, a lot of the projects are really cool and for community benefit, and you can get a complete sort of education in that process of bringing something and manifesting something valuable into the world. Like this might, you know, I think that the kind of education that is emerging, it's more hands-on, experience-based, and project-based.
Mm. Hannah, I wonder if we could ask you, what's your sense of optimism, perhaps, of is this ready to take off on scale? You've met a lot of people who are doing precisely that kind of thing. Is it big enough to really catch on?
I mean, I hope it will be in the future. I think right now it's definitely we're still trying to weed through that you have to go to college in order to get a good career thing. I definitely see that among my peers. As I was saying with my year of service, I mean, you're right. When I went to my 4 years of college, never did I think walking into this I would learn so much. And all of the things that allowed me to actually get a dream job at Save the Children were from the year of service, were from things that I had to seek outside of the resources I was given and from experiences that were hard to handle because I was on my own for it. And, you know, I don't know if anybody had really prepared me for that. I mean, besides, you know, like having, you know, good parents and good professors and everything, but it is intimidating to walk out into the real world and all of a sudden be like, well, what resources are for me and who's on my team, you know? So, I mean, in somebody who's doing it right now, I'm seeing firsthand that you can have a project and people are going to spark it and make it work if they stand behind it and if they believe in it. And I definitely agree that I am getting some sort of education that I've never received before just from being the founder of my own startup and from having to do fundraising and having to do all of that. So I definitely think I see that sprouting up a lot more for my generation. We're really creative and we really have creative out-of-the-box solutions and we just want to bring those to light. And since the resources aren't really being given to us to get conventional jobs and to be able to pay for everything, we're getting tired, and I think that's why we're going, you know?
Mm-hmm. So as we close here, could each of you just say a little bit more about how listeners can learn more about this world of sharing and the consequences if we don't share? Are you optimistic, Neil?
I'm both optimistic and pessimistic. I think that that things are getting worse and worse faster and faster, and at the same time are getting better and better faster and faster.
Interesting.
And it's really a race between the two. And the things that we talk about at Shareable are those case studies, are those signs that we could prevail and even transcend the sort of condition that we had, and live in a way that is dignified and rewarding and meaningful, and also good, you know, good for the planet.
Right.
That would give people experiences that consumer culture can't. And this is, I think, what's really promising. And so the place to go is to shareable.net, shareable.net, Shareable Magazine, and we have a whole how-to section, a link at the bottom of the page, which is probably the largest library of sharing how-tos on the Internet.
Fabulous, yeah. Fabulous. And, Hannah, could you remind us of your website?
Yeah, my organization is moreloveletters.com.
Okay.
But I would definitely also recommend checking out the Share or Die book, because, I mean, reading through that and just digesting what it's like, I mean, me and my peers, it's something that I think, like Neil was saying, it's a great guidebook, because we're definitely in changing times, we're in shifting times. It's scary, but it's awesome at the same time, and I think that the perspective of Shareable is one that it's really to be taken notice of, because they definitely think it's a way of the future. I'm definitely optimistic that it is.
Right. We really appreciate the work that both of you are doing. Thank you, Neil Gornflow and Hannah Brencher, for being with us on Ecotopia tonight. Neil is co-author of Share or Die, Voices of the Get Lost Generation in the New Age of Crisis. And did I say that right? Voices of the Get Lost Generation in the New
Age of Crisis.
No, the crisis has been there for me.
Yeah, right. And Hannah Brencher has an organization called More Love Letters. We really appreciate having you both on the show.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you,
Stephen.
Thank you. Great to be on the air with you too, Anna.
You too. Thank you.
Super. Thank you.
Bye.
Have a good night. You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico. We want to give you some forward promos of some shows we have coming up next week. I'm very excited to have Jim Gerritsen back. We interviewed him several months ago. He is involved with a lawsuit with OSCADA, the Organic Seed Growers Association, and he's the president of that organization, and he'll be talking about the lawsuit regarding Monsanto's patents that blame the people who end up with Monsanto products on their land. And Jim is a hugely passionate, very active guy. He was part of the Farmers Occupy Wall Street last year. So he's just, in addition to being a fabulous farmer in Maine, he's a really wonderful guy.
We also want to tell you that this week in Chico at the Peace and Justice Center, we're running a leadership institute for 10 young people between the grades of 8th grade and 12th grade. And we're taking up some of the topics we explored tonight, making a difference while making a living. We'll be recording some interviews with those young people as the week progresses, and we'll have excerpts of that for you next week as a follow-up to this program.
And then 2 weeks from tonight, that's the first Tuesday in August, that will be our 200th show. And we'll be doing a memorial to Ernest Kallenbach, who died just a few weeks ago. Ernest Kallenbach is the author of Ecotopia, the inspiration for the title of our program, and the inspiration for a lot of people who care about living sustainably.
And coming up at 7 this evening is The Storyteller with your anthropological guide, Adrian Scott, bringing you stories, legends, and music from long ago and modern-day cultures. Join Adrian for a trip around the world exploring the hopes, fears, and dreams that are universal to all people.
And at 7:30, host Senor Felipe serves up East L.A. Cholo, Soul, R&B, Oldies, Blues, Doo-Wop, Latin Folk, and Gospel. L.A. Sounds takes you back home to the roots where it all began. Back on the Block, Come On Home with Senor Felipe. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by EcoCab, Chico's green alternative taxi service. EcoCab provides safe, reliable transportation 24 hours a day in a new fuel-efficient Toyota Prius. Protect the planet and get to where you need to be with EcoCab, the cab that cares. Call 591-3186.
We want to thank you for listening to Ecotopia tonight. Contact us at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com or visit our website, ecotopiakzfr.net. You can also become our friends on Facebook and receive advance notice of upcoming shows. Again, thanks for listening. I'm Stephen Chudy.
And I'm Susan Chudy. Good night.
Fill my cup again, sing it with me.